NATSI Local 891 presents Apple Box Talks,
the podcast where we get to talk to the very best in entertainment, the artists and technicians of 891.
From prep to post and everything in between, we create worlds on screens of all sizes. Welcome to Apple Box Talks. I'm Crystal, and this week we're joined by another veteran of the film industry with credits such as Elf, Elysium, and The Muppets Wizard of Oz. Now he's been giving back to the union for the last 6 years as business representative. We are honored to chat with Phil Clapwick. So pull up an Apple Box and let's talk. All right, Phil.
Hi, Crystal.
Hi. Hi, boss. So let's just get straight into this. So we'll get it done is what I saw in your survey that you filled out.
We will get it done. Yes.
So exactly what do you mean by that?
Well, all I can say is that throughout my career in the film and television industry, I've often been presented with giant logistical challenges or impossible situations, and we've always figured a way out to figure it out and always found a pathway to achieving the vision of the director or the director of photography or, you know, the requirements of the licensing agencies or whatever. We've always found a way to do it. And that's the thing that really, you know, gets me about working with people from IATSE Local 891, the other professionals I work with, is that we're all committed to just making it work. It's the best part of the job.
Yeah. And so talk to me a little bit about your varied history, because you have such a sort of dynamic and diverse background in so many different areas. How did you make the transition into film 20 odd years ago?
Well, you know, I think I hang my hat entirely on the fact that I love lighting. I love the way that light plays on different objects. I just like the different colors that light provides. There's just something magical about the way light shapes objects for people. And throughout my, I guess one of the moments that really triggered it for me was when I signed up to do a high school play. And the director said to me, "Do you want to help out with the lighting?" And I had no idea what that meant until he handed me a light that probably weighed about 70 pounds, made out of cast iron back then, and pointed me to an extension ladder and said, "Climb up that 30-foot extension ladder and hang that thing on the water pipe in the ceiling of the gym." And I had no idea why, but I did it, risked my life and limb. And I think it's kind of criminal now. I don't think they'd be allowed to get away with that. But the upshot was, when we were doing scene changes and using a stick with notches cut out of it to turn off and on circuit breakers, I fell in love with lighting. I fell in love with the way that lighting created space on a stage that showed what the action was. And from there, you know, that translated into a love of theater and the camaraderie and the building of the show and all of that. And you really found a whole group of fellow circus performers who really enjoyed being a family. And then I went to school for theater, and I got various degrees in that. And I was really committed to the world of theater and the art of theater and as really a highbrow, nerdy scholar in theater, and had never ever considered film or television. And in fact, I was working in Vancouver at a local theater here, and I was designing lights and running the lights on a show. And I got a call from somebody who was desperate to find anybody who had any experience in electricity, because the industry was booming in BC at that time. And I had my electrical ticket, so I was on a list. They called me, said, "Can you come out?" And I said, "Sure, but I got to leave by 7 o'clock every night because I got to do my pre-show for the play." And they were like, they were so desperate. They're like, "That's fine. We'll just deal with you during the day." And I remember the look on the gaffer's face when at about 6:30, I said, you know, I got to go. And he said, he's like, you can't leave. You just can't leave a film set. And I said, but I got this other responsibility. Anyways, it was a really remarkable situation to make the entry. And I had resisted going into film and TV, because I was in love with the theater. But, you know, I after the first week of a steady paycheck, plus realizing that there were so many other people creating the same sense of family that I got out of the theater, I found my home.
And so you have worked on some pretty major films that have taken you some pretty interesting places. Yeah. Let's first start with the iconic Elf.
Well, Elf was a really interesting project. I did a day call on the show out at Riverview, where they had the house that it was built inside one of the rooms in Riverview, and where they did the whole breakfast scene and all of that stuff. It was really interesting. But they did the Santa sleigh landing outside on the grounds of Riverview. And I remember distinctly slipping around in all that pig lard that was fake snow everywhere and hating it. But at that time, I was just day calling, and the rigging gaffer asked me if I wanted to become the lighting console operator on the show. And at the time, my name was on the list for it, but I hadn't done a lot of that work. It was something that I did throughout my theater career, so I was really familiar with how to do all that. Well, that became an incredible window into all of the different sets, because when you're a lighting console operator, you're integral to the moment and creating special effects and lots of lighting, and you have to be on almost all the time. And so I did that for a whole bunch of years, and it gave me opportunities to be right on the inside of some of the best films that I think that we've done here, some of the best work I've done. Seventh Son, Elysium was fantastic. It was a spaceship that was crashing to Earth throughout the entire movie. So there's various bits of decay, and the lights were all flashing, and we did all sorts of unique things. Chronicles of Riddick was another one that was a real eye opener. One of the other lighting console operators and I got a lighting console that was in its experimental stage. It was a beta model from Germany. It was so new that it only had a German instruction manual. And it, you know, was a computerized console that we had no idea how to make it work. But we had an idea as to how we could bend standard rock and roll procedures to film lighting fixtures. And we basically came up with a system that's the way that we do it nowadays everywhere. And to be involved at that level and to be able to create a system where a director of photography could walk onto the set and say, okay, I want to see, you know, one bulb in, you know, the north side of this stage in every light fixture, and just go click, click, and have it happen. And then he'd say, no, I want the other one, and go click, click. And his eyes grow wide, because normally it would take, you know, 15 minutes to program that kind of change with all the levers and knobs. But this was a touch of a button. It was brilliant the way we adapted it. There's just so many opportunities. It just grows and grows.
Yeah. And, you know, that speaks to the amount of problem solving and creativity that go hand in glove with every single department. So some people might have some misconceptions about the lighting department. Can you speak to what some of those might be, and maybe dispel some myths that might be out there?
Well, I think a lot of people probably think we're the most arrogant department. People really don't understand often what the jobs entail. So misconceptions come about because they're not directly involved with attempting to achieve what each department's objectives are. But one of the things that being in the lighting department has taught me is that we're all integrated. There's really a level of service that the lighting department provides for every other department, being where the electricity comes from. And everybody on set is requiring electricity to perform their jobs. So part of what the lighting department does is serves every single department. But in order to do that, you have to interface with them correctly to get their needs and assess them and figure a way of doing it. And so one of the jobs I held for a while was as a rigging gaffer. And that was one of the key positions that taught me that you really had to be that forward-facing, problem-solving interface with all of the other departments and rely on your communication skills and you know, just be open.
So as a gaffer then, first of all, let's explain to someone who might not know what a gaffer is, what a gaffer does, and then talk to me about kind of what are the types of skill sets that you would look for to build your team?
Well, a gaffer is an old term for what we're turning to calling the either the chief lighting technician or the head lighting technician. I prefer head lighting technician. It's the leader in the department for lighting, which basically designs all of the lighting under the direction or in conjunction with the director of photography and the key grip. The gaffer is responsible for all of the actions that are done in achieving the vision of the director of photography from the electrical and lighting side. There's a big distinction between lighting and grips in that lighting guys create the light and the grip guys create the shadow. So we're basically working hand in glove to achieve a vision. Within the department, there are very specialized skills as well that people bring to the table. From my perspective as a gaffer, I always looked for a whole diverse array of people that could do various different things and had different perspectives on what the jobs were, because you never knew what challenge you were going to be presented with. And I'm not kidding when I tell you that I looked for a tall guy and a short guy. And when I say guy, I mean people from all genders. I don't necessarily mean just a male, because honestly, having somebody from a female gender on the team really elevated the sense of working together and problem solving, just simply because of the different perspectives. So I always looked for a whole group of people, some people with really great technical fine skills in electricity, people that could solder. I would look for people that could just be lift heavy things. That's really important. Yeah. As well. And also people that aren't afraid of heights. You know, that we do a lot of work at elevation. And so you need people that are not afraid to get out on a limb and really stretch their boundaries. So there's a whole differing array of needs within the department. Most of the technical stuff you can learn. So if you come at it with a good attitude, you can learn a lot if you just are patient and absorb and watch the people around you and pick up on the skills that they have.
So on that mention of skills, you brought a whole skill set with you into the industry, but you also were able to access some of the education benefits that 891 offers. Can you talk to me about that long trip across the pond you took?
Well, that's part of the whole evolution. You know, IATSE is one of the best institutions for supporting our members with training opportunities. And I have to say that for a while there, our past treasurer called me the most expensive IATSE member around, because I took a lot of courses and I would do a lot of training. But, you know, it came to a point where I was sent to a convention in England on behalf of IATSE, behalf of the lighting department, to attend and bring back information about the latest trends and where we were headed. And it was when I got back after that trip that I realized, you know what, I've gained so much from IATSE, and I need to step up and give back to the organization. So coincidentally, that next week, there was a lighting meeting, lighting department meeting. And I decided to go. I went on the Sunday, I showed up, I gave a little report about where I'd been and what I had done. And at the end of the meeting, the chair of the department said, we're looking for people to get involved at the co-chair or alternate chair level. And I said, well, I'll put my hand up. Why not? I'll help out. And then next thing you know, I'm on the bargaining committee. And next thing you know, somebody says you should run for business rep. So that's where I got. You know, there's so many opportunities with IATSE, and life is better as an IATSE member when you actually fully participate in the union.
Yeah, I would wholeheartedly agree with that. I remember when I first got in, I started learning about the labor movement, but it wasn't really until I started participating in those committees. And I know you're part of 30 plus committees across industry, yeah, which is vital for the functioning of our, of the health of our film industry. So it's wonderful that you decided to give back in this way. Some people might not know this about you, but in addition to your improv career, you have a BA in communications.
Yes. And a master's in theater.
So I wanted to talk to you about the importance of soft skills and in what it is we do on set.
It's remarkable when you start talking to the other people on the film set and getting to know their backgrounds, because there's a dizzying array of educational backgrounds that people have, and you never would realize it unless you start talking to them. But there are people who've taken, you know, education degrees who, you know, are using the skills that they have found in organizing curriculum, to now set up, a mentorship program, ad hoc mentorship program, stuff like that. Like there's all of the stuff that people bring that are soft skills and that they've learned elsewhere are generally applicable within the industry. There's no end to it, really.
I want to come back to some of the bigger shows that you spent your time on. One of them took you to Cape Canaveral. Can you talk about that?
That was remarkable. That was Tomorrowland, a film that shot up here, and then a group of us went to down to Florida to shoot on in Disney World. I think it's Disney World in Florida. Then we also went on to Cape Canaveral to shoot at the Apollo launch site, which was probably one of the biggest moments of my film career, is walking down the path that had the train tracks from where they built the rockets to the launch pad. And looking at all the pebbles that were down there underneath the train tracks, and the guide said those are specially dredged river rock from a specific river outside of Nashville, and they chose that because the mineral content of those rocks mean that if they rub together, they won't create a spark. Because when they originally created the rockets, they were worried about jet fuel like exploding. So the level of detail to that, where they'd go and dredge a river to bring rocks to Florida to put that together, was remarkable. And then you look around at the launch pad and all of the piping and all of the conduit for all of the electrical and all of that stuff is in like perfect, pristine condition where it looks like it's a submarine. So all of the pipes go in one direction to make a 90 degree turn, all together at the same place. It's fascinatingly integrated. And you realize that they drew all this and calculated it all with slide rules. Like there was no, computers back then. So walking that pad was remarkable, even made so more so remarkable by the launch of a SpaceX rocket on a launch pad that we could see from where we were shooting. So it was a stunning day.
That sounds like an incredible moment. Yeah. Speaking of incredible moments, can you think of one really outstanding memory that you have on a set?
I had a remarkable day shooting a commercial for the Whistler Film Festival, and I was part of a team that shot a helicopter landing at the top of, I think it was Blackcomb, the very top. Like you can't get there. There's no lift that goes up there. So we had we were taken up in gators or whatever it was. I can't remember actually how we got to the top, but literally the peak. We shot for 6 or 7 hours up there and loaded all the skidoos back up with all the gear, sent it all back down. I was the last person up there, and there was not enough room on the skidoo for me to fit onto the last skidoo. And so they went off and they said, "We'll come back and get you." And I ended up sitting up there and they forgot about me. So I was there, the top of a mountain, literally top of the world, perfect blue skies, looking everywhere and comfortable, and just not knowing when they'd get back to me. It was about an hour and a half that I had up there by myself. I was beginning to get a little nervous, but it stands out as one of the most amazing days in my life on a film set, because it was a place that you just would never be.
Yeah, for sure. And, and so people keep coming back here. And when I say people, I'm referring to studios and networks and Canadian producers, American producers, producers from all over the world. Why do you think that is? Why do you think we're such a hotspot?
I like to think of it's a lot because of the people. You know, we have a really stable tax incentive program here in British Columbia, which doesn't hurt, but that's created by the people. And it's the people that actually have the relationships with the government that ensure that the tax incentives stay stable. It's also the talented people that are actually working in front of and behind the cameras here in our industry. Top-notch talent everywhere you look. We have people that actually travel the world but still call Vancouver home and can't wait to get back here to shoot on projects in British Columbia. So there's talent, there's the tax incentives, and also, of course, the time zone. We are very favored to be in the same time zone as California, which is the hub of a film and television production in North America. So that doesn't help either, or doesn't hurt either, but it's all, for me, all about the people.
That's really interesting, because listening to the journey of Phil, so we've started in theater, we've gone on to a couple of other things.
And I just kicked into my business rep mode, didn't I?
Yeah, and so, then into, you know, on set and gaining that experience, and then being elected by, you know, almost our just shy of 10,000 members. And you're on your sixth year of serving as our business representative.
I should say, though, that when I was elected, there was only 5,250 members. So it's because of me that we're now sitting at 10,000 members. I'm kidding. It's not because of me. I had nothing to do with it. But.
Well, that brings me to my next question, which is, like, within the business rep's office, just give us kind of a snapshot of some of the things that you do for the membership.
Yeah, you know, it's an interesting position. I never would have thought that it was as detailed or as wide ranging as it is. The former business representative of 891 told me when he handed me his job description at the beginning when I took over, he said, "This is what I did. You make it whatever you want to make it, but this is what I did."
Was that like the 65 page document you had me read?
Yes, it was. And I don't do any of that. No, I'm kidding. No, the job actually, it's focused a lot on ensuring that that 891 is put forward at the top of the industry and maintaining the relationships with the studio executives plus industry stakeholders internally in British Columbia. And also the government, and making sure our relationships are strong with our government sponsors and partners. So, but it also has a great deal to do with negotiating. And it's not just negotiating our collective agreement, it's negotiating with the regulators when they want to enforce a certain regulation in a certain way that impacts the industry. We get involved in advocating on behalf of the membership to ensure that the way we work is going to be preserved so that we can actually offer the top tier service to our clients. It's so far ranging. It's all about, it's marketing, it's advertising, it's public relations, media relations, government relations, community relations. It's so wide ranging. I can't even begin to tell you the depth and breadth of everything that we do.
Yeah. And within some of those initiatives, I know that you've worked really hard on environmental impacts and equity and inclusion efforts, and, you know, just even your enthusiasm with planning our Pride Parade activities when we participate. I mean, you're in there and you are there because you're supporting our membership. And I know a lot of people are appreciative for that.
Yeah, there's a lot of things that I'm drawn to, and I think that the membership resonates with that kind of enthusiasm as well. We all have our issues, and I believe that the members there's so many different causes that they want us to get behind and throw our energies into. And there's, you know, we can go in 8 million different directions, but it's always the members first, and putting them first and making sure that we're creating a better world for them and for their children. And, you know, it's for me, my proudest achievement in the role as business representative has been the work we've done in terms of reconciliation, equity, diversity, and inclusion. We're not anywhere near being saying we're done, mm-hmm. but I can say that we are setting ourselves up for success in the future.
Wonderful. If you could have worked on any film or TV show with any filmmaker, who or what would that have been?
The one that I'm really passionate about from a lighting perspective is working with Darius Kanji, who was a cinematographer on the production of Seven. And that's where he did a bunch of other films that are really notable as well. And he's still there as a working cinematographer. But the one that captured my mind was the commercial hit of Seven, which of course starred Brad Pitt and Gwyneth Paltrow. And the lighting in that and the sensitivity to the framing and everything was just exquisite. And the use of modern technology and a new type of processing for the film was really remarkable. So for me, it would have been to work on a film with Darius Kanji. But I also said the Coen brothers. And that for me would be the pinnacle, to work with people who treat story in such a unique and different way. The Coen brothers are always approaching their scripts from a different point of view. And what they come up with is a synthesis that tells the story and everything is right. And when you get those movies that actually feel right from beginning to end, whether or not you like the story, like some of the things they've done, I've thought, well, that's just a terrible movie because I don't agree with the story, but it's really well done. Like all of it's really well done. So I'd say between those two, if I could get the three of them together, that'd be fantastic.
That's great. Now, sorry, that was my second last question, actually.
Yeah, of course.
I want to know, and we're going to probably ask everyone that comes on this podcast this question, because there are so many people that, you know, call in or email in and just need some basic information, some, you know, some guidance, that sort of thing. So if there's one piece of guidance you'd give somebody looking to get into our industry, what would it be?
Well, I have two pieces of guidance. First of all, I'd say is figure out what you want to be and then do that. I've heard so many people say that they want to be a director of photography and then they go and work as a lighting guy. And, you know, some of those skills are helpful, but you get trapped in the routine of the job that you're doing. And it seems like it takes forever to graduate to being a director of photography. I would say if you want to be a director of photography, go and be a director of photography. Learn that skill as being a director of photography. And that applies throughout all of the jobs, I think, that we have in within 891. However, there's a great benefit to getting mentored and being led along the way and building on the experience of the professionals that have gone before and learned the craft and learned it in a new way. So I wouldn't say that you can be functioning as a top tier artist or technician in 891 as a department head without having deep knowledge of all of the jobs that are underneath of it and personal lived experience in those roles. So if you want to stick to a department, go and figure that out and learn how to do all of the jobs in the department. But the second piece of advice I would give is take it easy, because nothing is that important. And I know that early on in my career, there was a lot of difficulty, a lot of stress involved around trying to do the work and trying to accomplish things. And there'd be skirmishes and battles over territory and, you know, jurisdiction over who touches what or whatever. And in the end, it doesn't really matter. We all get it done together. So stand back, take a breath, and just be open.
Well, thanks, Phil, for sharing your life as a lighting technician and the transition into business rep and for all you do for our union.
Thanks, Crystal.
And that's a wrap on Apple Box Talks. Join us again for our next episode on ourwork.ca.